After weeks of turmoil, the Trump administration is finally starting the transition to a Biden administration.
We maintain very good working relationships with all our elected officials, including our attorney general. And we may disagree on some issues, but we are united on this one. And we think it's time to pull the country together.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 24th, big business executives push for a White House transition, and now that it's begun, what corporate America says it wants from the new president. Also, some small businesses are bouncing back amid the pandemic, but still others may be forced to shut their doors permanently.
Any small business in an industry that requires personal touch, high levels of personal contact, and also people actually physically visiting the establishment, those are the kinds of small businesses that have been hit the hardest.
The official transition to President-elect Biden's government is finally underway. Last night, Emily Murphy, the administrator of the General Services Administration, formally acknowledged President-elect Biden as the winner of the election, clearing the way for the long-held-up transition process between the Trump and Biden administrations. President Trump, however, has not publicly conceded the election. And corporate America might be patting itself on the back right now after more than 160 business leaders on both sides of the political divide signed a letter to the president urging him to begin the transition. Among the signatories were David M. Solomon, the chief executive of Goldman Sachs, and the heads of MasterCard, MetLife, Condé Nast, and the Partnership for New York City, a coalition of hundreds of top corporate and investment leaders. Catherine Wild is the president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City, and one of the signatories, and she joins us now. Catherine, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Why did you decide to sign this letter to the president to pressure a transition of power?
We were asked by the state attorney general, Tish James, to join a call Friday night to talk about the implications for our democracy and, equally important, for our fight against the COVID, which has become the biggest crisis our country has ever faced, both in health terms and economic terms. And Tish James, the Attorney General, asked us to step up. She said that the Attorney Generals from around the country had been talking and saying the New York business community has a lot of influence with political figures, both at the state and federal level. They come here to raise money on a regular basis for their campaigns. And so they were thinking of who could, that it would be important for business to speak out and say that this is a threat to our democracy and a threat to our country's recovery from the COVID. So that was that's the background. So we met Friday night, and in 24 hours, we had top executives from major employers and leading investment firms on a letter just asking for what happened last night, which is that the GSA went forward in terms of authorizing the transition and ascertaining that the president and vice president-elect were Biden and Harris.
Now, the Attorney General for New York, Letitia James, has had her eyes on the Trump administration and is pursuing different investigations into the Trump family and others. But the tone of this conversation that you all had included business leaders from all sides of the political divide, including some who supported President Trump. Would you say that the tone was, were you surprised by that? Was the tone of the leaders generally amicable?
No, we keep an open relationship. The relationships between business and the political world in New York City are practical and are, you know, we're basically all interested in the future of the city and the country. So we maintain very good working relationships with all our elected officials, including our attorney general. And we may disagree on some issues, but we are united on this one. And we think it's time to pull the country together, drop the political scene, and focus on recovery from the COVID.
President Trump said one of his promises when he took office was that he would be big, good for business. Would you agree with that so far? I mean, now, as we assess his first and only term in office, would you agree that the president, this presidency, has helped businesses?
I think that, yes, the 2017 Tax Reform Act certainly was very positive, reduced the corporate tax and helped business. Although at the same time, the elimination of state and local deductibility hurt the 11 states that represent 53% of our national economy. They are states like New York, which have large budgets to support our public transit system, to support our large population of low-income people. So those states that contribute most to the economy also assume most of the country's burdens. So that hurt New York. So there has been, and there also, in terms of the policies on immigration, have hurt us in terms of being able to continue to attract global talent to this country. The immigration policies have created much agony in the communities of particularly the undocumented communities. Those are places where in New York, the business community is very supportive of the immigrant community, wants a path to citizenship. So there have been pluses and minuses. Overall, the economy has seemed to do well, but we are a nation divided at this point, among other things, over who is president. And that's not good. It doesn't allow us to tackle and put all our united energies at tackling this disease that is killing several hundred thousand people.
The Obama administration made efforts to really focus on private-public partnerships in terms of getting the work of the federal administration done. What do the leaders that you've spoken to, particularly the signatories to this letter, expect from a Biden administration?
There's been great disappointment with the division between Republicans and Democrats in Washington, that they were not able, for example, to get one of the big programs that that had been promised, investing in America's infrastructure, $1 trillion. That's one thing they expect and hope will happen. And using public-private partnerships to leverage private financing at a time when the government is devoting so many resources toward the COVID impact, this is a moment for the private sector to step up. We are talking about that effort in New York State, and we certainly want to see that effort at a national level. It's all across this country. We've fallen behind in terms of upgrading our transportation, our water systems, our renewable energy investment, our infrastructure in the broadband area. We're slow in all those areas, and this is a moment when we ought to be focusing there. And again, if we can get the partisan divisions put behind us and just focus on what America needs right now, we think that that's the way forward. And our business leaders, I think, by signing this letter on what amounts to a very controversial topic, I think they showed that they are going to have courage to push forward on uniting us behind getting some of the big policies done and programs done that we haven't in the past 4 years.
Catherine, you've mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic, which has forced so many Americans out of work. It has forced many people to become food insecure. It has forced people to adapt to new work environments that in many ways have become almost excruciatingly difficult for people. And again, a lot of Americans are even facing evictions as they wait for more stimulus from the federal government. What can the business community do to help ameliorate some of the pain that regular Americans are feeling, the financial pain and the lack of employment that many of them are facing, particularly as we head into some of the darker weeks of this pandemic?
Well, there are a number of things there. In the immediate term, obviously, we need an additional federal stimulus package, which since June, there's been an effort to get additional funds. The funds that were appropriated in the CARES Act last spring were anticipating a three-month term of the pandemic, and now we're in month 9, and this is so the needs have of people and the suffering of people has really not been addressed for the past beyond those first 3 month periods. So that's one thing that we all have to work together, and the business community is very supportive of additional stimulus and also focusing attention on those sectors of the economy, low wage workers on the one hand, and on the other hand, small businesses that have been ravaged by this. In New York City, we have 230,000 small businesses. We expect as many as a third of those will not survive the pandemic. Already 500,000 of their employees have lost their jobs during this. And now with the second surge coming our way, we're very, very concerned about losing more jobs, more businesses, and the results of that will be obviously huge pain and suffering and potential civil unrest. So this is not good for our country. You mentioned the eviction potential. There is a moratorium on evictions, both residential and commercial small business in New York and in much of the country, that the end of that is December 31st. What are we going to do when that happens? We've got to have a plan. And that's why we need to be focusing not on the results of the electoral process or what's going on in the courts. That's a distraction from, we ought to be figuring out how are we going to help people make up the back rent, because very few people have the resources to be able to pull out of their pocket, particularly if they've lost their job, a year's back rent. And we already have a huge homelessness problem. I could go on and on. Unfortunately, we have a cascade of tragedies and challenges. And so that's why we can't be fighting over who won or lost an election that was over weeks ago. We have to be focused on how are we going to solve these problems. And that's got to bring all parties together for that solution. That's the passion that our business community in New York feels, and I think businesses across the country, as I'm communicating with our counterpart organizations in other states. They really want America to come together and figure out how we're going to help those most in need and how we're going to rebuild our economy.
We're going to be talking about the effect on small businesses later in the show. Catherine Wild is the president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We just heard from one of the major players in corporate America who was putting pressure on the Trump administration and on Republicans to get on with the presidential transition. And now with the transition underway, business leaders are going to start to lay the groundwork for a relationship with the Biden-Harris administration. Kate Kelly is a business reporter for The New York Times and author of the book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, and she joins me now. Kate, welcome to the show.
Tanzina, thank you so much for having me.
Kate, we just heard from Catherine Wild, chief executive of the Partnership for New York. Who are some of the other major corporate players who are not just acknowledging Biden's victory, but who sort of surprised you by speaking out?
I'm not sure that any individual surprised me so much as the size of the group surprised me. I think in the end, they had about 164 signatories to this pretty strongly worded statement saying that the lack of a transition was a threat to national security and that our democracy was weakened by the situation. Certainly that there was urgent business to contend with in the United States, although I think that's a pretty much universal agreement. But it was just quite a sharp message to the administration, I think geared toward Emily Murphy, the general services administrator who needed to determine that the election was over with a Biden-Harris win, but also implicitly to President Trump. And these are business leaders who, for the most part, like to try to avoid being in the political spotlight. They will get involved with issues that are important to their employees and their businesses, whether that be taxes, tariffs, immigration, issues like that. But to really strongly criticize a sitting administration is rare.
A sitting administration that is essentially a lame duck, though. I mean, was this a way to also try to curry favor with the Biden administration now that more folks have become more comfortable saying that the Trump administration is essentially over?
I don't think so. I think that there are people on that list who are registered Republicans. And now, to be fair, some of those supported Biden and were not fans of Trump, although typically they would vote Republican. And I assume, although I couldn't tell you a name, there are people on that list who voted for Trump as well. One interesting development yesterday was that Blackstone, the private equity firm, spoke out in two ways. The president of the firm, John Gray, signed the letter. Now, of course, Gray, if you follow him, is a big Biden supporter and was hosting fundraisers for him at the very bottom of his political process back in February, where he was behind in the primaries. But at the top of that firm is Steve Schwarzman, the CEO, who has been not only a very generous Trump and Republican donor, but has been an informal advisor to Donald Trump for these 4 years. And Schwarzman did an interesting thing. He left it to Gray to actually sign the letter on Blackstone's behalf. But Schwarzman spoke out in his own statement and said, you know, words to the effect that the election is over and it's time to move on. So I think coming from someone like him yesterday, that was notable as well.
We talked a little bit about this in the previous segment, but was the Trump administration good for corporate America?
I think in many ways, yes. Now, of course, it depends on what kind of business you're in. But yes, in many ways it was. In his very first year in office, Donald Trump managed to pull together a package of tax reforms and get them passed through Congress that lowered the corporate tax to 21%. And in some cases, lowered individual taxes. There were some elements to that that benefited, for example, the real estate business by preserving some advantages that real estate companies had. Now, some would argue that for smaller companies and for limited liability corporations, it was another story. But by and large, that was a benefit to corporate America. The tariffs, many people were hawkish on China in terms of tariffs in the business community and thought that America needed to take a harder line when it came to protecting our intellectual property from being stolen and or demanding better trade terms from China. So I think many regarded that as a benefit. And then, of course, there were the environmental protections that were rolled back, the war on regulation, parts of the landmark financial regulation reforms that were passed after the great financial crisis in 2010. These laws were passed, started to be weakened or rolled back. So you had a business-friendly package, to be sure. But the pandemic this year has, of course, been immensely damaging to the economy. And although I think there's consensus that any president would have struggled with this pandemic, in fact, Barack Obama on your colleague Terry Gross's show said that, there is a feeling that President Trump didn't do enough to meet the challenge head on, did not warn Americans and with that companies and employers early on to take measures, to have a federal mask mandate, to have a sort of coherent federal-led strategy that would allow us to control the spread of the pandemic and with that, the economic repercussions, which have been very, very deep and grave.
The transition from a Trump administration to a Biden administration has officially begun. What role would any of these folks have, any top business leaders have in the transition team? Will they be talking to these folks to kind of help lay the groundwork for what a Biden administration can and should do with corporate America?
I think some of them already are. You look at that list of signatories from the letter and somebody like Blair Efron from Centerview Partners, which is a financial advisory firm, or even John Gray, who I mentioned earlier, those folks are in touch with Team Biden. They were very active donors, had access to the candidate and his team, and very well maybe informally advising the transition team and incoming administration on various things. In terms of whether these business leaders will be appointed to senior positions, I think we're not going to see a lot of that. If you look at the wave of announcements we saw yesterday, somebody like Janet Yellen, who came through the Federal Reserve System and is now the Treasury Secretary nominee, or Jake Sullivan, who will be on the White House team, these are not people who come from Goldman Sachs or private equity. These are people with a different sort of background who have previous government experience. And I think there will be something of an allergy in the Biden administration to having senior Wall Street people or other corporate people in these jobs. Not to say there will be none, but I think there's an awareness on the part of the Biden-Harris team that Wall Street has a bad reputation, especially in their progressive wing. And they're going to have to be compromise brokers within the Democratic Party. And I think a former candidate like Senator Elizabeth Warren or Senator Bernie Sanders, who worked hard to help get Biden elected, would really look askance at selections like those. But the other interesting thing about Joe Biden is, from my understanding, he does not have a ton of friends on Wall Street. He is someone who, as we've heard on the campaign trail, was in government for 47 years. His home state of Delaware, yes, is a place where a lot of corporations are based, and there are companies like DuPont and credit card companies, and he got to know those business leaders. But partly because of all his time in government, partly because this campaign was waged, somewhat virtually, he did not have a chance to really get to know people along the way. So I think to name somebody from Goldman, and we're just using that as an example, but from one of these Wall Street firms or even a lot of corporate firms would not necessarily be the natural fit for him.
Speaking of the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, I mean, we've seen more growing corporate activism under the Trump administration. Is that something you would expect to see increase under a Biden administration?
Yes and no. I think this is a long-term trend and a really interesting point. My colleagues and I have observed that you have a moment here where maybe it's the younger generation of workers and a sort of idealism that you sometimes see. Maybe it's because of the weakening of institutions like religious organizations. But people increasingly look to their employer to help them fulfill a sense of mission. And they want to have employers who are principled, who have values that they resonate with. And I think partly because of that, and partly because Donald Trump was such a galvanizing commander-in-chief who raised very difficult questions about immigration, about equality, about so many issues, you saw that companies were in some cases trying to fill the void and speak out on behalf of their employees and their values. So I think that
thinking about things like when companies came out and said Black Lives Matter, for example.
That's right. And I think companies were animated by events like early on in the Trump administration, you had the travel and immigration ban. You know, generally, that's bad for companies. They look overseas for talent and they want to have a workable visa program, not to mention they need their employees to freely travel around the world. Another case would be Charlottesville. That was an extremely galvanizing event for many, many Americans, not least of which workers and workers in companies. They wanted, if their president was not going to say, I'm not drawing a moral equivalency between neo-Nazis whose actions result in the death of someone and counter-protesters, they want their bosses to do so. And Black Lives Matter is yet another example. So yes, I think there have been a number of galvanizing events, and the president in many cases has fanned the flames of controversy as opposed to calming them. But I think this long-term trend is probably here to stay of a greater degree of corporate activism on targeted issues that really matter to employees and business.
Kate Kelly is a business reporter for the New York Times. Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
We just heard the latest on how corporate America is doing during the pandemic as big businesses look ahead to a new administration. Now we're going to get the latest on what COVID-19 means for small businesses nationwide. The initial months of the pandemic dealt a serious financial blow to many small businesses. About 1.4 million closed either temporarily or permanently in the second quarter of 2020. That's according to Oxford Information Technology. And that wave of closures placed a significantly deeper financial burden on Black and Latino-owned businesses than white-owned businesses. But with many states reinstating restrictions on businesses during the current wave of COVID-19 cases, many small businesses will likely have to shut back down and find themselves waiting for additional federal aid. So we asked some of you who are small business owners how you've adapted during the pandemic and how you're planning for the coming months.
Hi, this is Caroline Hurst from Charlottesville, Virginia. I had to close my small business in May due to COVID, but even if I hadn't had to close, I would have had to close down anyway due to my kids being in virtual school and needing me to be home to basically homeschool them while they navigate the virtual learning experience.
Tom Zielinski, and I'm a small business owner in Dallas, Texas. I'm afraid that majority of all my colleagues that I've worked with for the last 30 years agree that many of us are going to be out of business before this is over, thanks to our government officials shutting down the entire economy, which has killed us. Large corporations want to run the country and own the country. I guess they're going to get their way because we can't survive. We're done. There's no work. There's no way to pay the employees, and people are starving. There's no help from the government. Nobody seems to care.
Victor Schwartz, founder of VOS Selections, importers and distributors of fine wine and spirits. Best assistance we've received, besides the PPP, has been a significant reduction in our rent from our landlord. That's been very, very helpful. Next few months, I sell to a lot of restaurants. And with the vaccine, I think it's going to change the perception of people, even if it's not fully distributed. It's going to help a lot. Right now, all of our businesses shifted to retail, and we've managed to survive, thank God, through this period.
My name is Jeff Ederer. I'm from Denver, Colorado. Obviously, this 2020 has been a very challenging time. However, I own a small business in college planning, consulting, and what we found is this has really been a boon for us as we've converted much of what we do to Zoom, and that's allowed us to really reach out to a lot more people. We've ended up really having, we'll have our best year yet. So for us, we're feeling fortunate, but definitely it's been a great year for us, really, because it's forced us to look at how we do our business in new ways.
Thanks so much for sharing your stories with us. We want to keep hearing from small business owners out there, so give us a call at 877-869-8253 to share with us how you've been able to adapt during the pandemic and how you're planning for the months ahead. More on what the pandemic has meant for small businesses across the country, I'm joined now by Amara Omokwe, economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Amara, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So earlier in the show, I spoke to Catherine Wild, who's the chief executive of the Partnership for New York City. And she said that about a third of New York's small businesses could close when everything is said and done with the pandemic. Is that what we're seeing roughly nationwide?
So what we've seen over the course of this pandemic is that small businesses have recovered. So the economy has recovered roughly half the 22 million jobs that were lost early on in the pandemic. And that is a good sign for small businesses because small businesses account for about half of private sector employment. And we've also been tracking data that looks at the number of active business owners across the U.S. And that has rebounded from a very steep plunge earlier on in the pandemic. But there are a lot of challenges that could still mean that small businesses close or that they face significant headwinds in the weeks and months to come. One of the big things that is happening right now, as we all know, is that coronavirus cases are surging across the country. And what that means is that state and local governments have re-implemented restrictions meant to curb the virus's stem. And so that affects the ability of small businesses to operate, generate revenue, and continue to recover.
Are there specific types of small businesses that have been hit harder than others during the pandemic? I mean, here on the show, we've talked about the effect that the pandemic is having on restaurants, for example, because of limits on indoor dining. But what other industries, small businesses, have been hit hard?
So basically, any small business in an industry that requires personal touch, high levels of personal contact, and also people actually physically visiting the establishment, those are the kinds of small businesses that have been hit the hardest. So you mentioned restaurants. Restaurants still are down by about 2 million in terms of employment compared with pre-pandemic. Live and sporting events, leisure and hospitality small businesses, those are the kinds of establishments that really have not recovered to the extent as other small businesses have. For instance, professional and business services. Those small businesses weren't hit as hard early on in the pandemic, and we have seen them recover a little bit better than other small businesses that require people to come in or require people to be in contact with one another.
How have small businesses, the ones that have survived, adapted best to some of the changes? And again, using restaurants as an example, we've seen some folks, you know, set up outdoor dining here in New York with heat lamps, et cetera. What about other small businesses? How are they adapting?
So it's really about doing things that make consumers feel comfortable or doing things that allow consumers to interact with the business virtually, right? So we've seen and talked to a lot of small businesses that are talking about boosting their website so that customers can shop online. At the same time, however, a lot of small businesses were able to participate in the Paycheck Protection Program, which was the federal government's main way of supporting small businesses through offering forgivable loans. But of course, as you know, Tanzina, the federal government is kind of stalled right now on offering additional aid to small businesses amid this huge gridlock in Congress. And so small businesses really are running out of that lifeline, or they are just anticipating and hoping that Congress passes more aid to help them along.
We should note that New York Public Radio, which produces this show, The Takeaway, received an $8.9 million loan through the Paycheck Protection Program. We know that there's gridlock in Congress. Does Joe Biden, has he addressed this at all? Does he have a plan to start on day one should Congress not pass additional stimulus funds for small business before he takes office?
Well, President-elect Biden has really been sort of encouraging Congress to get something done now. He's encouraged Congress to not wait until after the inauguration to pass a package because of the need that is out there in the country. But he's sort of maintained this posture that if we can get cases down, get the public health crisis under control, that will give consumers more confidence to go to that small business, to support that small business, and also give small businesses more of the resources they need to be able to operate safely.
Amira, there's some data that talks about how Black and Latino-owned businesses are doing better at this point in the pandemic than they were several months ago. What's driving some of that recovery?
Well, I think what happened is that over the course of the Paycheck Protection Program, Congress and the Trump administration realized that the program wasn't reaching minority communities perhaps as well as it should have. And so they implemented measures over the course of the program to ensure that the program was better flowing to those communities. For instance, they set aside a certain amount of money for community development financial institutions, which often do a really good job of getting loans and other kinds of capital into minority communities. And so I think that certainly helped sort of improving this federal lifeline and making sure that it reached those businesses. I think another thing that's happening is that small businesses have turned to other sources of aid. There are states and local governments that have rolled out their own programs for small businesses. And in the wake of the killing of George Floyd over the summer and this national conversation that we were having about racial injustice, you know, a lot of state and local governments said, we're going to roll out programs specifically for minority-owned businesses. And so I think Black-owned businesses and other minority-owned businesses have been able to take advantage of those sorts of resources as well.
What specifics would small businesses like to see from the next congressional relief package?
One thing that a lot of small businesses have said to me is that they would like to see a program or re-implementation of the Paycheck Protection Program that addresses the neediest of businesses, right? So the first iteration of PPP was sort of really broad. It was a huge lifeline kind of just thrown out there for all to kind of take advantage of. And small businesses have said to me, let's make sure that this next package focuses on those hardest hit industries like restaurants, like leisure and hospitality, like those small businesses that really saw a huge decline in revenue and that didn't come back. A lot of small businesses that already took PPP loans are also looking for a simplified forgiveness process. So you'll remember that a big draw of PPP was that these loans are forgivable if businesses meet certain criteria. But just looking at the applications that have come out for these businesses to apply for forgiveness, a lot of them are concerned that it will take a long time for them to get their documents together and to go through the process. And so they're really looking for Congress to sort of simplify the process, make it really easy so that they don't have to take time away from keeping their businesses afloat to apply for forgiveness.
Also, as we mentioned earlier, the PPP loans were also, you know, really not limited to, I think when a lot of people think small businesses, they think a certain dollar amount that might not be in the millions of dollars, right? Is there anything that's really geared towards small companies, maybe mom and pops, you know, single owner type businesses, or will they also have to compete with larger, maybe mid-sized businesses to get that type of cash?
So a lot of the proposals that are out there in Congress about how to restart PPP do have specific sort of carve-outs for businesses with 50 employers or fewer. There are also some proposals out there that would make it so that a business had to demonstrate a certain percentage drop in revenue in order to qualify. So it does seem like if PPP were to be restarted, Congress is really thinking about how to make it a little bit more targeted than the first round. And another interesting thing is that Congress is also, a lot of congressional proposals have also sort of proposed set-asides for community development financial institutions and other community lenders to sort of address on the front end the ability of minority communities to access this program. Whereas during the first iteration of PPP, it was sort of on the back end as they realized that it wasn't really reaching those communities. This time around, it seems like they're thinking about it up front.
If federal aid doesn't come soon and we are beginning across the country in different states at different capacities to implement what some people are calling a pause, other people might call a modified lockdown, for example, shelter in place, stay at home, whatever it is, this is going to hurt small businesses if they don't get the money that they need. How can some of these folks survive the next couple of months?
I think that one thing that small businesses are thinking about is how to continue to meet consumers where they are. And so they're looking at programs, whether that be in their local community through civic organizations that can help them, for instance, boost their websites, get online payments going, those sorts of things. And I think small businesses have shown throughout this pandemic that they're really creative, whether that means pivoting to a different line of business or changing the way they do business entirely. That's what small businesses are going to try to do absent any further federal aid. But I think just looking at data, looking at surveys, small businesses have been really clear that they need additional help. And so I don't really think it's optional if we want to see small businesses continue to weather this pandemic.
You're in touch with small business owners for your reporting. What are some of them telling you about how they're feeling? Because the what I hear a lot in New York is, you know, some folks are saying this is it. If we go, you know, if we have another lockdown or shutdown or modified shutdown, they won't be able to make it. But what are you hearing from the folks you're actually talking to?
I'm hearing that also. It's a lot of uncertainty as these cases ramp up again. One thing that small business owners are saying is, you know, I took a PPP loan, so that kept me afloat. I've been able to make adjustments to keep myself afloat. But it's also about consumers, right? If people are losing their jobs because businesses are closed or because there's uncertainty out there in the economy, consumers pull back on spending. They don't necessarily spend on things that they don't need. And so that affects the ability of small businesses to have that customer come in or go to their website to buy a product. And so everyone is intertwined. So to the extent that there's uncertainty out there and consumers say, let me maybe not make that big purchase or maybe make that discretionary purchase because I'm not feeling confident about what's going on, that affects the ability of small businesses to survive.
Amara Omokwe is an economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Amara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn to the consumers to ask how spending could look different during this year's holiday season. Black Friday is this week and normally the biggest shopping day of the season, but COVID means a lot fewer so-called doorbuster deals and mobbed department stores and a lot more people headed online from the beginning. And we asked you how your spending habits may be changing this season in the face of COVID.
Hi, this is Cheryl calling from Stanford. Thankfully, my husband and I still have our jobs. The only difference this year is that we've done most of our shopping early and online so that we can hopefully avoid all the shipping delays and any possible COVID exposures.
I am going to be making some changes this year with holiday shopping. I'm going to make a strong effort to buy locally and from small businesses because they've all been hurt so badly this year.
Hi, this is Keith from Dallas. For Christmas, we are going to have our kitchen redone and place that money that we would have spent for Christmas presents into our home.
It's Matt Brazil in San Jose, California. This year, because of COVID, I'm making sure that I spend in small businesses where the business gets to keep the money instead of some big corporation online that enriches shareholders.
The historical Wayside Inn in Sudbury, Massachusetts has started a fund for brown, indigenous, and people of color to do programming around their lives and culminating on Giving Tuesday. So I'm going to put my money where my mouth is because it takes more than just putting the sign on the lawn.
Here to talk about what the COVID holidays will look like for consumers is Ayala Rubio, an associate professor for the Department of Marketing at the Broad College of Business at Michigan State University. Welcome to the show, Ayala.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So we just said that the holiday season will probably have folks migrating online. What do we know in terms of how much people are looking to spend this year? Are they going to be making different choices about holiday spending?
So COVID really accelerated a lot of patterns and trends that we've seen in recent years. One of them is the switch to more shopping online, and obviously that will increase. Data suggests that about 28% are saying that they're going to cut down on their spending this holiday season. But, you know, it's more like I'll start dieting tomorrow, right? So I think we'll see that although maybe people are planning on spending less, I don't think we'll see much change in spending. We'll see more change in what people are spending on. So what are they buying? And we certainly see that people are buying more things that they can do at home or they can use at home. So we just heard about that person is going to renovate his kitchen, you know, all kinds of do-it-yourself type of projects. You know, Xbox and PlayStations are rocketing sales right now. So everything that has to do with spending time at home will sell very, very well.
Black Friday is this Friday coming up. Retailers generally open the doors and we see those scenes of people mobbing department stores. That's not going to happen this year. Black Friday deals are all across the internet. What other things are retailers doing to try and meet their bottom line for what's usually a very busy shopping day?
So, yep, retailers are getting very, very creative. So does consumers, by the way, but retailers cannot create that excitement of Black Friday in the store as they did before COVID. But certainly what they will do, instead of having special deals that are only offered in store to generate foot traffic, they will offer things online that will be either limited time or exclusive offers to members or, you know, loyal consumers, or things that will generate the same level of excitement, but online and not in the store.
We were just talking about small businesses, and I'm wondering whether or not, you kind of mentioned this earlier, but will we see some of these businesses have actually gotten creative enough to stay afloat during the pandemic? Some of them are, you know, resilient in that. And I'm wondering if they'll see a little bit of a bump from consumers who want to support their local businesses.
So it's true that, listen, all businesses are hurting, big and small, but certainly small businesses have less resources to stay resilient, especially in times like these. There was, before the pandemic, there was, again, a shifting trend where more consumers were looking for those special item, unique item, things that big retailers cannot offer. And we saw a surge in sales when it comes to small businesses. Hopefully that will come back. Certainly consumer wants to support their local businesses and help them go through these times. It really is a matter of resilience and what are the resources that small businesses have in order to stay afloat, which is not easy, and not all businesses obviously can do it, especially when everybody's switching online. Not all businesses have a good online infrastructure for selling to begin with, or are able to do so. But certainly there's a lot of willingness from consumers to support small businesses in their community. So we'll see that continues.
We're also hearing a little bit about how consumers might be facing shortages again in essential products like toilet paper, the famous toilet paper runs, and bottled water potentially. Do you expect that that'll happen if in the next couple of weeks as stores start to tighten up in anticipation of a potential, maybe not a full lockdown, but definitely more modified behaviors expected from Americans as we try to fight this COVID pandemic?
If we have any shortage, my guess it will be a very short-term one. I think that retailers are preparing for that. They certainly will be much more prepared than they have been in March when everything just kind of crashed on us. And I think, you know, what creates shortage is a sense of urgency. I don't think consumers are experiencing or exhibiting the same sense of urgency they did in March. I think they're managing the situation much better. They have a better sense of control over the situation. So the sense of urgency is not that steep, and they can certainly manage that. And I don't want to, you know, the lockdown, the new restriction are being administered differently across states. So, you know, not in every state, they are forcing you to stay home. So I don't think we'll see the same, you know, level of shortage or urgency from consumers for sure.
Ayala, do you have one tip for people who might be shopping online this year? Something that they should be careful of or avoid or do?
Yes. So consumers are going to spend about $400 million on the internet this holiday season. Just be careful. There are a lot of scammers out there looking to make a buck. Don't help them. Be careful with what you're reporting, with your credit card information, with your personal information. But have fun. This is a holiday too, a holiday season. Just have fun.
Thanks for that reminder. Ayala Rubio is an associate professor for the Department of Marketing at the Broad College of Business at Michigan State University. Ayala, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's another show in the books, everybody. Please stay safe out there and keep wearing your masks. And if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. It's available wherever you find your podcast, or you can go to thetakeaway.org. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.